Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What I have been discussing in the current series is based on a book called The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown, an attorney. And this essentially is a series of shows delving deeply into the myths about money. We're looking at the shocking truth about our money system and also ultimately how we can break free, because our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized. It's not something that the government runs. It's been taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. So what we've been trying to do through the web of debt is unravel the deception and to present a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading collectively. But we will also explore workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. We care about our financial security, both nationally and individually, and that's why I'm going into great depth in the history, the theory, and the understanding of where we stand regarding debt in this country, and through us, the whole world. Before I get going, I'd like to give an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Ellen Brown, and I highly recommend her books, particularly The Web of Debt. Also, a number of shows have already been produced regarding this topic, so you can go to the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt to see where we have been and what we have discussed in this area. All the related shows will be under Life and Debt Web. By way of some review from last show, we are essentially in a game of smoke and mirrors, and I was discussing the Federal Reserve. As the writer indicates, illusion surrounding the Federal Reserve begins with its name. The Federal Reserve is not actually federal, and it keeps no reserves, at least not in the sense most of us think. No gold or silver backs its Federal Reserve notes, which are our dollar bills. A booklet published by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York states, quote, currency cannot be redeemed or exchanged for treasury gold or any other asset used as backing. The question of just what assets back Federal Reserve notes has little but bookkeeping significance. End of quote. The Federal Reserve is commonly called the Fed, confusing it with the U.S. government, but It is actually a private corporation. It is so private that its stock is not even traded on the stock exchange. The government doesn't own it. You and I cannot own it. It is owned by a consortium of private banks, the biggest of which are Citibank and JP Morgan Chase Company. These two mega banks are the financial cornerstones of the empires built by JP Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, the robber barons who orchestrated the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. And we'll look more at this later on in the series. As for keeping reserves, U.S. Senator Wright Patman decided to see for himself a number of decades ago. Having heard that the Federal Reserve banks hold large amounts of cash, he visited two regional Federal Reserve banks where he was led into vaults and shown great piles of government securities. Now, what's a government security? It's an IOU representing debt. By way of a footnote, a security is a type of transferable interest representing financial value. The securities composing the federal debt consist of U.S. Treasury bills or T-bills, securities which mature in a year or less, Treasury notes which mature in 2 to 10 years, and Treasury bonds which mature in 10 years or longer. Now back to Senator Patman. When he asked to see their cash, the bank officials seemed confused. He repeated the request, only to be shown some ledgers and bank checks. Patman later wrote, "The cash, in truth, does not exist and never has existed. What we call cash reserves are simply bookkeeping credits entered upon the ledgers of the Federal Reserve banks. These credits are created by the Federal Reserve banks and then passed along through the banking system." And that's the end of the quote. Well, where did the Federal Reserve get the money to acquire all the government bonds in its vaults? Patman answered his own rhetorical question. It doesn't get money. It creates it. When the Federal Reserve writes a check for a government bond, it does exactly what any bank does. It creates money. It created money purely and simply by writing a check. When the recipient of the check wants cash, then the Federal Reserve can oblige him by printing the cash, Federal Reserve notes, which the check receiver's commercial bank can hand over to him. The Federal Reserve, in short, is a total money-making machine. Of course, the Federal Reserve is indispensable to the banker's money-making machine, but the dollar bills it creates represent only a very small portion of the money supply. Most money today is created neither by the government nor by the Federal Reserve. Rather, and this is hard to swallow, it is created by private commercial banks. The money supply is defined as the entire quantity of bills, coins, loans, credit, and other liquid instruments in a country's economy. So again, the money supply is just bills, coins, loans, credit, and other liquid instruments. Liquid instruments are those that are easily convertible into cash. The American money supply is officially divided into M1, M2, and M3. Now, only M1 is what we usually think of as money, coins, dollar bills, and the money in our checking accounts. M2 is M1 plus savings accounts, money market funds, and other individual or small-time deposits. The money market is the trade in short-term, low-risk securities, such as certificates of deposit and U.S. Treasury notes. M3 is both M1 and M2, plus institutional and other large-time deposits, including institutional money market funds and euro dollars, American dollars circulating abroad. Now, I hope it doesn't get too complex here, but this is really an important understanding. In 2005, M1, remember that's the coins, dollar bills, and checking account deposits, tallied in at $1.4 trillion. Federal Reserve notes in circulation came to $758 billion, but about 70% of those circulated overseas, bringing the figure down to $227.5 billion in use in the United States. Once again, that's coins, dollar bills, and checking account deposits. The U.S. Mint reported that in September 2004, circulating collections of coins came to only $993 million, or just under $1 billion. Considering our nation's size and economy, that doesn't amount to very much. And I'll continue in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's get back to our analysis. So the M1 category, there's not much money in terms of coins, dollar bills, and checking account deposits in America, $227.5 billion. Used in the United States. But now let's jump over to M3, which is coins, dollar bills, the money in our checking accounts, plus savings accounts, money market funds, and other individual or small time deposits. It's actually M1 and M2 together, plus institutional and other large time deposits, including institutional money market funds and euro dollars, which are American dollars circulating abroad. That makes M3 the largest of the money supply measures. And in 2005, it was approximately $9.7 trillion. So if you do the math, coins made up only about 1/10,000th of the total money supply, which is M3. And tangible currency in the form of coins and Federal Reserve notes, which are dollar bills, together made up only about 2.4% of M3. Now, we have to think about that. Let's step back. What does that mean? It means the other 97.6% magically appeared from somewhere else. As I mentioned earlier, when Wright Patman was discussing this, this was the money which he said was created by banks when they made loans. And we want to underline the word created. They are literally creating the money when they're making the loan. The mechanics of money creation were explained in a revealing booklet that was first published by the Chicago Federal Reserve in 1961 and was later revised in 1992, titled Modern Money Mechanics, a workbook on bank reserves and deposit expansion. This booklet turns out to be a gold mine of insider information, and we will explore it at length later on. But some of the highlights are important at this juncture. It begins with, "The purpose of this booklet is to describe the basic process of money creation in a fractional reserve banking system. The actual process of money creation takes place primarily in banks." It then explains, banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is to accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts. That bears repeating. Banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts. The booklet goes on and explains that money creation is done by building up deposits and that this is done by making loans. Now, that is completely contrary to what we believe. Loans become deposits rather than the reverse. The whole process has been flipped upside down. This book goes on and explains, Banks can build up deposits by increasing loans and investments so long as they keep enough currency on hand to redeem whatever amounts the holders of deposits want to convert into currency. This unique attribute of the banking business was discovered many centuries ago. It started with goldsmiths. End of quote. Now, what does that mean? The unique attribute discovered by the goldsmiths was that they could issue and lend paper receipts for the same gold many times over. So long as they kept enough gold in reserve for any depositor who might come for their money. Now, this was a total sleight of hand, later dignified as what we call today fractional reserve banking. Now let's take a step back in time. Trade in the 17th century Europe was conducted primarily with gold and silver coins. Coins were durable and had value in themselves, but they were hard to transport in bulk and could be stolen if not kept under lock and key. Many people therefore deposited their coins with the goldsmiths, who had the strongest safes in town. The goldsmiths issued convenient paper receipts that could be traded in place of the bulkier coins they represented. The receipts were also used when people who needed coins came to the goldsmiths for loans. The mischief came, or at least began in our understanding, when the goldsmiths noticed that only about 10 to 20% of their receipts came back to be redeemed in gold at any one time. In other words, they could safely lend the gold in their strong boxes at interest several times over as long as they kept 10 to 20% of the value of their outstanding loans in gold to meet the demand. They thus created, quote, paper money, which was receipts for loans of gold worth several times the gold they actually held. They typically issued notes and made loans in amounts that were 4 to 5 times their actual supply of gold. At an interest rate of 20%, the same gold lent 5 times over produced a 100% return every year. This on gold the goldsmiths did not actually own and could not legally lend at all. If they were careful not to overextend this credit, the goldsmiths could thus become quite wealthy without producing anything of value themselves. Since more money was owed back than the townspeople as a whole possessed, the wealth of the town and eventually of the country was siphoned into the vaults of these goldsmiths-turned-bankers, while the people fell progressively into their debt. Well, if a landlord had rented the same house to 5 people at one time and pocketed the money, he would quickly have been jailed for fraud, right? But the goldsmiths had devised a system in which they traded not things of value, but paper receipts for them. The system was called fractional reserve banking because the gold held in reserve was a mere fraction of the banknotes it supported. In 1934, Elgin Grosskloss, director of the Institute for International Monetary Research, observed, "A warehouse man taking goods deposited with him and devoting them to his own profit, either by use or by loan to another, is guilty of a tort, a conversion of goods for which he is liable in civil, if not in criminal law. By a practice which is now elevated into an economic principle, but which has no defenders outside the realm of banking, a warehouse man who deals in money is subject to a diviner law. The banker is free to use for his private interest and profit the money left in trust. He may go even further. He may create fictitious deposits on his books, which shall rank equally and ratably with actual deposits in any division of assets in case of liquidation." That ends the quote. A tort for those who don't know, is a wrongdoing for which a civil action may be brought for damages. A conversion is a tort involving the treatment of another's property as one's own. Another tort that has been applied to this sleight of hand by the banks is fraud, defined in Black's Law Dictionary as a false representation of a matter of fact, whether by words or by conduct, by false or misleading allegations, or by concealment of that which should have been disclosed, which deceives and is intended to deceive another so that he shall act upon it to his legal injury. And that term was used by the court in a landmark Minnesota lawsuit in 1969, which we'll discuss in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's continue in our discussion of how banks were given the authority to use a sleight of hand for its own profit. In 1969, there was a case called the First National Bank of Montgomery versus Daley, and it was a courtroom drama worthy of a movie script. Defendant Jerome Daley opposed the bank's foreclosure on his $14,000 home mortgage loan on the ground that there was no consideration for the loan. Now, what's consideration? Consideration is the thing exchanged, and this is an essential element of a contract. Both sides have to exchange something that's theirs. Daley, an attorney representing himself, argued that the bank had put up no real money for his loan. And if we review what I just discussed, they're not using any money at all when they give out a loan. Well, the courtroom proceedings were recorded by Associate Justice Bill Drexler, whose chief role, he said, was to keep order in a highly charged courtroom where the attorneys were threatening a fist fight. This is 1969. Drexler himself hadn't given much credence to the theory of the defense until Mr. Morgan, the bank's president, took the stand. To everyone's surprise, Morgan admitted that the bank routinely created the money it lent out of thin air, and that this was standard banking practice. Well, it sounds like fraud to me, intoned Presiding Justice Martin Mahoney amid nods from the jurors. In his courtroom memorandum, Justice Mahoney stated, "Plaintiff admitted that it, in combination with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, did create the entire $14,000 in money and credit upon its books by bookkeeping entry. That this was the consideration used to support the note dated May 8, 1964, and the mortgage of the same date. The money and credit first came into existence when they created it." Mr. Morgan admitted that no United States law or statute existed which gave him the right to do this. A lawful consideration must exist and be tendered to support the note. Well, in this case, the court rejected the bank's claim for foreclosure, and the defendant kept his house. To Daley, the attorney, and the person who signed the mortgage, the implications were enormous. If bankers were indeed extending credit without consideration, without backing their loans with money they actually had in their vaults, and were entitled to lend, a decision declaring their loans void could topple the power base of the world. He wrote in a local news article his thoughts on this. He said, "This decision, which is legally sound, has the effect of declaring all private mortgages on real and personal property and all U.S. and state bonds held by the Federal Reserve, national and state banks to be null and void. This amounts to an emancipation of this nation from personal, national and state debt purportedly owed to this banking system. Every American owes it to himself to study this decision very carefully, for upon it hangs the question of freedom or slavery." Needless to say, however, the decision failed to change the prevailing practice, although it was never overruled. It was actually heard in a justice of peace court an autonomous court system dating back to those frontier days when defendants had trouble traveling to big cities to respond to summonses. In that system, which is largely phased out, judges and courts were pretty much on their own. In that particular case, Justice Mahoney went so far as to threaten to prosecute and expose the bank. Interestingly, he died less than 6 months after the Daley trial in a mysterious accident that appeared to involve poisoning. Since that time, a number of defendants have attempted to avoid loan defaults using the defense Daley raised, but they have met with only limited success. As one judge said off the record, using a familiar Wizard of Oz metaphor, and for those of you who are new to the program, the Wizard of Oz actually runs parallel as an allegory on banking in America. But back to what the judge said, if I let you do that, you and everyone else, it would bring the whole system down. I cannot let you get behind the bar of the bank. We are not going behind that curtain. Just like the wizard behind the curtain in Wizard of Oz, which I've discussed in previous shows. In an informative website called Money, What It Is, How It Works, William Hummel states that banks today account for only about 20% of total credit market debt. The rest is advanced by non-bank financial institutions, including finance companies, pension funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, and securities dealers. These institutions merely recycle pre-existing funds, either by borrowing at low interest rate and lending at a higher rate, or by pooling the money of investors and lending it to borrowers. So in other words, they do what most people think banks do. They borrow low and lend high, pocketing the spread as their profit. But that's part of the curtain, because what banks actually do is something quite different, and Hummel explains. Banks are not ordinary intermediaries. Like non-banks, they also borrow, but they do not lend the deposits they acquire. They lend by crediting the borrower's account with a new deposit. The accounts of other depositors remain intact and their deposits fully available for withdrawal. Thus, a bank loan increases the total of bank deposits, which means an increase in the money supply. So back to the point, you loan the money as the bank, yet by doing that, the total of bank deposits has increased. Well, if the money supply is being increased, money is being created by sleight of hand. What we earlier called the diviner law of the bankers allows them to magically pull money out of an empty hat. And that's the point we'll end on this week, that the banks are, in fact, creating money, magically pulling it out of an empty hat. Come back next week, same time, and we will continue this amazing expose on the banking system. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.